This is CD 12 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains part 1 of session number 11 titled Devotion and the Guru.
Tonight we're going to deal specifically with the concept of the guru and the whole love and light phenomenon. It is particularly fitting that we do so today because today happens to be a very sacred day in the Hindu tradition. It is Guru Purnima Day, which is the day in which one can do anything one wants to one's guru. So in honor of that tonight, I would like to lecture first on bhakti, devotional techniques, love, the method of the guru, how it works, what you do, what the guru does, what doesn't do, and perhaps, if we can, the role of the witness as an aspect of the guru. Then, well, what I would like to do is to share with you a darshan, which means a spiritual visit, with my guru, since those of you that get any kind of a heart connection out of these lectures, although you won't believe it when I say it, some of you, I'd like you to meet the man behind the scenes, because it's really his trip. I am totally a wind-up robot, and you say, oh, now that's a hang-up in your mind, and we'll deal with that. Watch your emotional reactions to all this stuff as you go along tomorrow. So what we will do is, after I finish the lecture, we will do aarti, which is the light ceremony to the guru, which we do every day at our homes, our respective puja tables at homes. And I'll translate it for you, and then we'll do it for you. And at that time, we will be offering, as we talked about sacrifice or offering, we will be offering food, which then becomes prasad, or consecrated food, through the process of offering it. And the food that we are offering is a huge vat of halva, which it's Indian halva. It's very nice, and it was made with much love, and it has a huge Hindi Ram written on it in raisins, and it was made for you, for the guru. It'll be offered to the guru, and then it'll be taken to the door, and as you leave, you will be given some prasad from this experience, okay? When you receive it, it might just help, if since you might as well learn the Hindu traditions and play it, you know, you ought to be flexible enough to be a Buddhist on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and a Hindu on Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday. Okay. So when you are being a Hindu and you take food, the way to receive prasad is you hold your hands like this with your right hand on top, and a little of the food is put in your hand. You don't reach for it. You don't take it. It's given to you. Right? And you don't take it with your left hand. Okay. In India, it's very clear. You use the left hand to go to the toilet and the right hand to eat, and it's all very simple. We get a little confused here. After the aarti, the light ceremony, then we will continue with the slide presentation, and during the time we're showing you slides Rameshwar Das has prepared of Maharaji, I'm just going to give you little stories about him and little one-liners of what he said, and just convey to you a little bit so that you can visit with him. It's just visiting another being. You might not have a chance to go to India, and if you did, he's left his body, so it would be difficult. So we're bringing him here through technology. The technology of the heart. The reason we have to go to these lengths, if you will, is because the quality of bhakti or devotion is really not something that we can sit down and intellectually figure out. It is something that has to do with the heart. And there's a little absurdity about talking about heart trips. There's something that one feels or one experiences in a realm that is not necessarily conceptual. So that I haven't made this series of lectures very, very much talking about devotion and love, because I thought rather than talk about it, we just let it sneak in on us through the kirtan, through the singing, through the mala, the mantra of opening the heart, through just being together in love, and let it all happen to us individually. Because that is the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is concerned with service and with wisdom, the higher wisdom, but it is all ultimately in the Gita in a context of devotion. And chapter 12 is in a way the love focus quality of the Gita. But if you reflect on the way Arjuna is taken through the sequence by Krishna, you realize that at some point Krishna says to Arjuna, "It is because of your love that I'm allowing you to hear all this and see all this." And the vision that is bestowed upon Arjuna, which is an incredible grace to have that vision, the vision of the cosmic forms, the vision to open the third eye to see without looking, and the awesome and, in a way, horrible or awful nature of the vision, that was only bestowed on Arjuna because of his love, really, and his devotion, and the purity of his relationship to Krishna. And if you trace the sequence in the Gita, you see that there is a certain, what we call lower knowledge, lower jnana, which led to a certain kind of faith, because faith is sort of the lower mind having the faith in the possibility that it all is something else, which is what the higher mind knows, but the lower mind doesn't. And that faith leads you to purification, which we talked about last time. And that purification, as you quiet down, you start to open a bit, and that allows you to have some visions or some direct, immediate experiences, which leads you to a deeper kind of awe and devotion to it all, and finally to the higher wisdom, which is the wisdom of the Brahman and the wisdom of the Purushatma in relation to the Brahman. And oftentimes, I think that you may feel, especially as you are at Naropa, that there is a tremendous struggle going on between the head trippers and the heart trippers, between the jnanis and the bhaktis, between the people that say, be cynical, be tough, be cold, don't buy all that emotional crap, and the people that are saying, love, drown in the ocean of my love, it's okay. And it all looks sloppy and mushy and yuck, and the intellect looks so clean and tight, you know. But you've got to see that it's very much like a mountain, and that the different paths start from different parts of this very wide base of the mountain, and you start from where you're at. And then as you get up the mountain, these all things start to come together. And really near the top, it all becomes very, very, very intermingled. So that if in a advanced class or a weak moment, that couldn't be a weak moment, in an advanced class, you would get Trungpa, for example, to start to reminisce about his relations to his gurus, or talk about the devotional quality of Buddhism, you would begin to sense a lot of these qualities which he uses words that are much different. The most emotional word he gets are things like warmth. See? Because he's being very cool. But when I'm with him, I feel this incredible, loving, devotional being. Although I don't think that's his particular ray. And I think what you're being subjected to here at Naropa, in many different ways, through many of the different teachers here, is a recognition that the game isn't one of good and evil. You might sit around saying, look, he's a bad guy and he's a good guy, or she's wonderful and she's no good because they think that way. But as you get more sophisticated, you begin to recognize that as you go down the mountain, there are beings along the way down the mountain that are there to guide you, or that are vehicles of guidance, whether they think they are or not. They're placed in different parts of the mountain, and they represent what are called in theosophy various rays of God. And part of our work is to honor the various rays through, and realize that Trungpa represents a ray that is different than the ray I represent. It doesn't mean that the ultimate truth I can't share. Now the question is, how much your vehicle of getting to the top of the mountain should look exactly like how it would be at the top of the mountain. or how much you can afford dualism to get to non-dualism. That's really the crux of the issue of devotion. Because devotion is a dualistic thing. It is devoted to something. And if you're going to have to give up subject-object distinctions, wouldn't it be better not to get stuck in them in the beginning? That's really the general way that the thought sequence goes. Well, the predicament is this, that in order to absorb the wisdom through this direct experience, you have to be very, very intensely one-pointed in where you're going. And part of the lubrication that greases the process, an intense love for it, whether you call it a love for truth, or a love for God, or a love for Guru, it doesn't matter. But the emotional commitment is very intense. Recently, I was with some very advanced students of Trungpa's up in Washington State. They are sort of people who head these kinds of things we're into now. Not these particular ones. And we were driving back in a car from somewhere, and I was sitting there, and they always kid me a lot about me being this kind of slushy, devotional bhakti. It's a very loving kind of kidding, I think. And at least it is the way I'm receiving it. If it's not the way they're sending it, that would be their problem, of course. And they were talking about Trungpa, and they were telling Trungpa stories, which is a great pastime among Trungpa devotees. And as I was sitting there in the car listening, I suddenly couldn't distinguish between this and sitting in India telling stories about Maharaji. It had that same total love and adulation, and you know what he did then? And then he danced around the stupa, and they're describing how he danced and what it looked like, and I turned around and I said, you know, you're nothing but a group of sloppy bhaktis. I can't stand you, you know. And they said to me, well, don't tell anybody. So I, of course, am doing that specifically right now. Because love makes the thing happen so easily. That opening of the heart makes it happen so easily. In the Psalms, David says in the Old Testament, because my heart was enkindled, my reins also were changed. And in that horse image, that chariot image in the Gita, where the reins are the mind, and applying that, when my heart was opened, that made it easier for my mind to change. And that's really what the whole issue of devotion is a way of making it very easy to turn your heart to turn your mind in a certain direction. And at different times in the Gita, Krishna says one thing is higher than another, but in general, the devotional quality of whatever you're doing adds to what you're doing. And the whole business about dualism and non-dualism is, if you use a method that is dualistic, and use it with as much wisdom as you have, I can know perfectly well, as you will see in my talking about my guru, that that's not what it's about, but that's an absolutely first-rate vehicle through. And even though he knows and I know, and he knows I know and I know he knows I know he knows I know, still, it's okay. The method works, and then as the method works, you go beyond method and the whole thing falls away. But it has to fall away. The minute you push your heart away because you think it's too shoddy as a vehicle, it's going to cling. You're going to have a turned-off heart and it won't work. The game won't work so well. Because head-tripping will only take you so far and then you become like sort of parched dry leaves. And Krishna says in the Gita, it's very, very difficult to go the route of merely identifying with the unmanifest, which is the way of Zen. It's the shunyata, the way of just letting go of everything, nowhere to stand. It's a very difficult way. It's known as the path that has no railing, the high path that has no railing. It's like going straight up the mountain with no hand railing. And if you can do it, do it. If you can be it, be it. But the devotional quality which sneaks into all these methods just makes it all go so much easier. Hafiz, the poet, said, O thou who art trying to learn the marvel of love from the copybook of reason, I'm very much afraid that you'll never really see the point. Okay? That if to the extent that you try to think your way through this devotional issue, it's not going to make it. When I see people individually now and then, I notice how many people are just so heavy into their heads and they're just so afraid to love. just so afraid to let the liquid flow of the universe happen to them. They may be very much into their bodies and very much into their heads, but their heart isn't open. Again and again I say to somebody, you know, it's just not a strong heart connection yet. Because to get through the door, you can't close off anything. It's all going to be wide open. The fear of opening the heart is the fear of new attachment. And the problem is that every method, as you know, those of you that have meditated for a long time, how trapping it is, how hooked you get on meditation. All methods are traps. And in my relation to my guru, at first, look at his form and just be around him. And then as time went on, not that the love grew less, the love grew different, until I was very fulfilled just being at a distance in relation to him. And then as time went on, it kept growing deeper and deeper until finally I didn't really care whether I was with his form anymore. And then as I went deeper still, I started to relate to him in a way where it wasn't that man in India anymore. It was the essence of guru-ness. And then I began to experience it in myself in relation to him. And the whole quality of the dynamics of the relationship were changing as I was growing in wisdom and as my heart was opening and my surrender was greater. The way I've kidded about it is I worshipped his form until I suddenly realized that that was just the doorpost and I was just rubbing the doorpost. I've told you this. You know, I was just worshipping doorposts and saying my doorpost is better than yours doorpost. And I saw that was merely the door jamb, and you looked through and you kept looking through and each surrender led you in and in and in. And it was a method that took you right back to yourself and to beyond form. And a lot of the qualities of renunciation or intellectual discriminations that are really difficult when you're trying to do them in a rajasic, I can do it type way, in the presence of love, they're incredibly easy. Like those of you that have had a really powerful love affair, love relationship, will recognize what it's like to care more about your beloved than about yourself. And you can go, like you, your favorite food comes on the table. Can you imagine getting to the point where your main concern is that the other person have enough of it and that you're fulfilled that they should eat it? When you have a child, that's the kind of experience you get. And somebody says, aren't you self-effacing? Aren't you sacrificing to your child? But it isn't sacrifice, it's joy. And all austerities with a dry heart are really heavy. With love, they become like, oh yeah, wow, I'll do this for my lover. Do this for my beloved. I'll give this up. That'll get me closer. I mean, when you really want to get close to your beloved, boy, you can't give things up fast enough. You know, that's getting in the way. Oh, I don't want to read that. I can't do that because it'll keep me from my beloved. And we'll talk a moment about the intensity of that kind of love as it develops. One of the factors in enlightenment in Southern Buddhism is rapture. And rapture has that quality of the flow of feeling, And it's a factor for enlightenment. It's a helpful factor for enlightenment. And so the method we're talking about is bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion, the yoga of the heart, the yoga of love, of loving openness to God, to Guru, to Self, to God and other beings. The quality of love, as described by Mayor Baba, this is one of the most beautiful quotes that I've read. It says, love has to spring spontaneously from within. It's in no way amenable to any form of inner or outer force. Love and coercion can never go together. But though love cannot be forced on anyone, it can be awakened in him through love itself. Love is essentially self-communicative. Those who do not have it catch it from those who have it. True love is unconquerable and irresistible. And it goes on gathering power and spreading itself until eventually it transforms everyone whom it touches. This was the message of Christ. A being becomes love, and everything they touch is loved, is in the aura of love. And it's so interesting, the thing about it not being amenable to force. Out of the best intentions, it still doesn't work. I can sit with somebody and I can see that their heart is closed, and I want to say to them, open your heart. See? You ought to love more. And I say, what are you feeling? The person says, nothing. See? And then I try. I say, tell me about this and that. And then, what are you feeling? Nothing. Because I'm trying. Stop trying so hard. And I just hang out and I just love them enough. Just be here in love. After a while, they, you know, the person says, I don't feel anything. And then they'll get up and they say, can I hug you? Why do you want to hug me if you don't feel anything? I don't know. I don't know. Thomas Merton said, if you have love, you will do all things well. Paul in Corinthians. Love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, does not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not its own, is not provoked, taketh not account of evil, rejoiceth not in unrighteousness, but rejoiceth with the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hope all things, endure all things. Love never faileth. Every now and then in these lectures, I've dropped the line, but I've let it pass because it's a little far out for, without this course going on for quite a bit longer, the line, suffering is grace. And it's very hard for people to hear that. Suffering is grace. That when you've got all your troubles, all your sorrows, all your difficulties, all your weighty sufferings, which everybody has, that is grace that's been given to you. And that's far out because it sounds so Pollyanna-ish or so masochistic or something. And it's only in this space of love that that starts to make sense. Otherwise, it won't make sense to you ever. Reason will never allow you to understand the concept of suffering as grace. But the love that Paul's talking about is not romantic love. It isn't the level of I love so-and-so for their personality. It isn't that kind of love. It's what's called conscious love or Christ love. It's not possessive love. It's a place where you meet another being in your heart of hearts. It's not a needful, neurotic kind of thing. It has a quality of freedom connected with it, which most people don't associate love with. They associate love with an intense possessive quality. C.S. Lewis in Paralandra has conveyed that quality a little bit. He says, love me, my brothers, for I am infinitely superfluous. And your love shall be like his, meaning God, born neither of your need nor of my deserving, but just bounty, plain bounty. The love, like the Aditya mantra, shines on everything independent of whether it is lovable or not. You don't just sit and judge whether you can afford to love the thing. It's just much easier to love everything. Just put it on everybody. And people who say to me, but I don't feel any love. I don't feel any of the stuff you're talking about. I keep remembering this Thomas Merton quote from Seeds of Contemplation. Prayer and love are learned in the hour when prayer becomes impossible and the heart has turned to stone. It's only when your despair gets greatest that possibility occurs for that heart opening. So when somebody comes in and says, I feel nothing, I feel dead, it's horrible, to me that's the critical moment. That's the moment when the possibility of the heart opening, if the despair is just great enough. Sometimes you see it isn't great enough yet. They're still trying to think their way out. And I'd usually say, go away and suffer some more and come back in about a year. You know, you haven't suffered enough. Go suffer some more. People don't think that's compassionate. In our tradition of Ram, the statement is, Ram likes love only. A man who is able to know this can know. and out of traditions that we are familiar with, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength. If you take a line like that, which you've all heard thousands of times, you start to consider, could it possibly mean anything? Is it just a hype done by hypey people trying to control people? Could it possibly be talking about something that I could open to? The history of devotional yoga is loaded with examples of intensity of love, where the love gets so powerful. Meher Baba spent a lot of time going around washing masts. Masts are what are called God intoxicants. In this country, they would be put in mental hospitals and be considered psychotic. But there are some very clear distinctions. It's not that they are so much in the world that they're all screwed up about it because of their anxiety. It's because their fifth chakra is open and they've turned inward towards God and they couldn't care less about their body, about the social scene. It's just all fallen away. They can't keep it together. They don't remember their zip code. And Meher Baba used to go around and wash these masks, give them baths and keep them in ashrams and build places for them. These people that nobody else wanted to go near because they were just so crazy and flipped out. And we talked one night when a fellow was here, we talked about people who are going through stages where it's easy for you when they inconvenience you to say, well, that person's neurotic and I wish the hell they'd get out of the way. But there is another recognition which comes with your own quieting where you honor the fact that somebody is going through some very profound spiritual awakenings and that at that point they must be treated with a lot of love and compassion. And what we need is more ashrams of what is Trungpa starting with Maitreya, that kind of quality of place which is a total care scene for people who are going through these transformations, but with spiritual consciousness behind them. Ramakrishna said, cry unto the Lord with a longing and yearning heart, and then you shall see him. People would shed a jugful of tears for the sake of their wife and children. They would drown themselves in a flood of tears for the sake of money. But who cries for the Lord? I mean, think about what you've cried for in your lifetime. When somebody put you down? When you lost something? When you made a fool of yourself? And these masts, when this thing happens, this intense love, it's also referred to in the Bible, in Isaiah, when he's talking about these beings, and he says, they are drunken, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. There was a very, very beautiful devotee of God who sang, who created incredible songs. Her name was Mirabai. And this is an example of a song which, if you look at it from a hard-headed place, is absolutely grotesque. But if you can empathize with what it is like to love something so much that nothing else matters, then you can experience what Mirabai is singing about. When she says, oh, black vultures, eat away everything of this flesh, but discriminately. Leave these two eyes, for they still hope to see the Lord. O black vultures, pull out these eyes as well and take them to his presence. Only make an offering of them to the Lord before you devour them. Right? This intense kind of... The body means nothing. Recently, we put out these records called Love, Serve, Remember. And in the album, I did a reading of the fifth descent, the fifth chapter from Tulsidas's Ramayana. And Tulsidas, this is the kind of folk version of the Ramayana. And it is totally liquid bhakti love. And when you hear those records, you will hear what that quality is. Because I also read the third Chinese patriarch on those records, which gives you the other quality. The don't, you know, the total knife that's so sharp that you never even feel it cut. And this one is just, Oh, it's just like drowning in it, drowning in lush devotion. And this chapter that I read starts out with this opening, which will give you a feeling of just how completely drunken Tulsidas is. He's just starting a chapter, right? It's no big deal. He's just starting a chapter. And he's talking about Ram. He says, I adore the Lord of the universe bearing the name of Rama, the chief of Raghu's line, the mine of compassion, the dispeller of all sins, appearing in human form through his Maya, deluding potency, the greatest of all gods, knowable through Vedanta, constantly worshipped by Brahma, the creator, Shiva, Sesha, the bestower of supreme peace in the form of final beatitude, placid, eternal, beyond the ordinary means of cognition, sinless and all-pervading. There is no other craving in my heart, O Lord of the Raghus. I speak the truth, and you are the spirit indwelling the hearts of all. Grant me intense devotion to your feet, O crest jewel, and free my mind from faults. I bow to the son of the wind god, this is Hanuman, the monkey, the beloved devotee of Sri Rama, the chief of the monkeys, the repository of all virtues, the foremost among the wise, a fire to consume the forest of the demon races, possessing a body shining as a mountain of gold and a home of immeasurable strength. That's just the introduction paragraph. But you can feel the way of relating, of just loving and devotion and, just like sitting around and just like savoring your favorite food in your fantasies. It's that kind of love, that kind of intensity of love. Now, how is all this love and devotion directed as a useful technique of sadhana? Like, who do you love? You love your cat? You love yourself? What do you love of yourself? You love your guru? What part of your guru do you love? And what traditionally has been useful is either that one connects to the concept of a supreme, such as the Lord God, or Purushatma, or Ram, Krishna, or that you find some form on the physical plane that you can love through, you can use as a doorway through your love to go through it. And that is what the technique of Guru Kripa is about. Guru grace, Guru blessing, the method of the Guru. And that is my method. I was recently asked to review a book, and it was a book by some social scientists about some primitive phenomena, in which case they were assessing the Guru. And they lost me with this paragraph. They said, the Guru is a real or fantasied authoritarian figure whose basic function seems to be to represent a cultural sanction for the wanted or desired activity, and by his presence to help bring it about. That is as far as the intellect could ever understand about the Guru, because that's what it looks like from outside in. Okay? Because the way in which the relation of the Guru works has nothing to do with the kind of intellectual process, as you'll see from the quotes of my Guru later on. No known comparison exists in the three worlds for a true guru. If the philosopher's stone be assumed as truly such, it can only turn iron into gold, not into another philosopher's stone. The venerated teacher, on the other hand, creates equality with himself in the disciple that takes refuge at his feet. The guru is therefore peerless. And the way the guru, the relation of the guru works in terms of what we've been talking about, illusion, is beautifully, beautifully stated by Ramana Maharshi. See if you can get this image. It's like an elephant waking up upon seeing a lion in a dream. Okay? The elephant's asleep and it sees a lion in its dream, which forces it to wake up. Just as the appearance of the dream lion is enough to wake the elephant, so also the glance of grace from the master is enough to waken the devotee from the sleep of ignorance to the knowledge of the real. It is sure and certain. You realize what the implication of that is saying? That the guru, as a separate entity, only exists within the illusion of separateness. The minute it's worked to awaken you, it ceases to be anything. It's a self-destruct mechanism. Okay? You only use it until it opens you a certain way, and then you see through it. At one point, when I think I told you, I sat across from my guru, and I thought to myself, that body isn't what it's about. And then he sent the old man over to touch my feet, and I said, why did you do that? He said, well, Maharaj, he said, go touch his feet because he and I understand each other perfectly. Just at the moment when I said, he's not it. He was saying, good, go, go, go. Because once the awakening starts to happen, you incredibly love the things that help you along the way. You love your old nursemaids, you love it all. And you can continue to love them all. But the neurotic needful love diminishes, and what is replaced is this kind of conscious present love, where every time I love you, I am loving my guru. Mana Maharshi said, God, guru, and self are the same. They are the same. These are just different routes through to get to them. Now, what's happening within the guru and how that works, how the guru works? People say to me, do I need a guru? It's certainly good to have an external teacher to cut through your stuff. But the guru, that which beckons from beyond, is God, guru, and self are one. And you may meet it through self, you may meet it through God, you may meet it through guru. It will only be given to a very few of you to ever pursue the path of guru kripa. That's all there is to it. It's not bad or good, it's just the way it is. People say, how do I know my guru? You don't know it. There just won't be any doubt. You can never intellectually decide, well, this fits all my rules of guruhood, therefore it'll be my guru. Because it'll always undercut all your expectations. And you may decide, this shoddy slob, I wouldn't have anything to do with it. And it turns out to be your guru. There's a distinction between what's called upagurus and satguru. The satguru is the one, that same thing that is the Brahman, which may take many forms, but there's only one of it. And then along the way, there are upagurus, which are teachings, which are things that are there to, like marker stones along a road, which say, go that way, go that way. And most of us in our life will merely have upagurus. We will have teachings along the way. And I think it's a much more productive thing to look at other beings as teachings rather than teachers, and to take a teaching here, a teaching there, and then go on, instead of getting hung up, is this my teacher? Because that leads you into, you're going to make a big commitment, and you sit around judging and doing an intellectual trip, and that'll never work really well. Now, if you realize that the guru is finished, what could it look like from inside the guru when he's sitting with a devotee or she's sitting with a devotee? Though the master and his disciple appear as two people, the master alone enjoys himself under the guise of the two. It's like a flower turned into a nose to smell its fragrance. This is Yandev Janeshwar. It's like a solid substance which saves anyone from drowning in the water that does not exist, and the individual thus saved remains nowhere. See, from the guru's point of view, nothing is happening at all. The whole thing is a whole trip. I used to sit in front of Maharaji, and the closest thing I can describe, as I've said before, is I felt like Charlie McCarthy. I felt like he had created me out of his mind in order to play with me. It was like a cat playing with a mouse. You say, well, why would he do that? Well, you'll have to ask him. I have no idea. And as you start to develop this wisdom that we've been talking about, what often happens is that you quiet down enough to look around and you begin to sense that you are not alone in the situation and that you are being guided, protected, even though you thought you were doing it all yourself. Now, this could be because there are not only gurus on the physical plane, but there are astral guides as well. All of this is all just relative reality. We all know that. You don't have to keep backing away from it. But there are these astral beings which are involved with the physical plane and with us on the physical plane. There was a nice quote in Mount Analog by René Dommal, which is a lovely metaphor for those of you that have ever read that little book. And they go to this mountain, which is the mountain of consciousness, metaphorically, on an island that they compute its existence. And they come to the island and they start to climb the mountain. And they say, by our calculations, thinking of nothing else, by our desires, abandoning every other hope, this is the achievement mentality, by our efforts, renouncing all bodily comfort, we gained entry into this new world. So it seemed to us. But we learned later that if we were able to approach Mount Analog, it was because the country had been opened to us by those who guard them. The cock crowing in the milky dawn thinks that its call raises the sun. The child howling in a closed room thinks that its cry causes the door to open. But the son and the mother follow courses set by their own beings. Those who see us, even though we cannot see them, open the door for us, answering our puerile calculations, our unsteady desires, and our awkward efforts with a generous welcome. Now that may seem pretty far out to some of you. In Southern Buddhism, the relation to the teacher is called a kalyan metta, meaning a spiritual friend. Spiritual friend. And in Cutting Through, Trungpa speaks about the relationship that's necessary for the transmission between two people, one of openness and trust and warmth. And there is an absolutely beautiful quote from the I Ching that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. The master said, "Life leads the thoughtful man on a path of many windings. Now the course is checked, now it runs straight again. Here winged thoughts may pour freely forth in words, there the heavy burden of knowledge must be shut away in silence. But when two people are at one in their inmost hearts, they shatter even the strength of iron or of bronze. And when two people understand each other in their inmost hearts, their words are sweet and strong, like the fragrance of orchids." It's that quality of loving, trusting openness that allows you to receive the transmission from another being. It was my love and opening to Maharaji that allowed whatever blessings came through. And it's just like a continuous stream. It's as each person opens and loves, then it comes through. It just pours into you. And it doesn't have to be said in these kind of incredible, lush devotional stuff like Tulsidas. It can be in that kind of quiet way, as the I Ching said it, or the metta kalyan, kalyan metta of the Southern Buddhist. It can be very gentle, that little warmth, that little place. Along the way, a guru may use many powers. And the trick about powers is that most of the time, gurus use powers in order to loosen a person at a certain point when they're just ready for a certain thing to happen. There's a quote in Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi. "A few mornings later, I made my way to Master's empty sitting room. I planned to meditate, but my laudable purpose was unshared by disobedient thoughts," which would be familiar to you, I'm sure. "They scattered like birds before the hunter. Mukunda," his guru, Sri Yukteswar's voice sounded from a distant balcony. "I felt as rebellious as my thoughts. Master always urges me to meditate," I muttered to myself. "He shouldn't disturb me when he knows I came to this room to meditate." It's like you're in here meditating, and Trungpa walks in and taps you, says, "Could I see you?" And you say, "Don't disturb me, I'm meditating." He summoned me again. I remained obstinately silent. Right? I'm going to show him I'm meditating. You know, shouldn't bug me. The third time, his tone held rebuke. "Sir, I am meditating," I shouted protestingly. "I know how you're meditating," my guru called, "with your mind distributed like leaves in a storm. Come here to me." Thwarted and exposed, I made my way sadly to his side. "Poor boy," he said, "mountains cannot give you what you want." Master spoke caressingly, comfortingly. His calm gaze was unfathomable. "Your heart's desire shall be fulfilled," he said. He struck me gently on my chest above the heart. And then Yogananda goes on to describe a whole experience of cosmic consciousness that happened to him at that moment when he was touched, which is the same as when Ramakrishna touched Vivekananda with his foot. And Vivekananda yelled out, "But I have family at home." And then immediately, Yukteswar brought Yogananda back. And he said, "You must not get overdrunk with ecstasy. Much work remains for you in the world. Come, let us sweep the balcony floor." Okay. That's the way in which powers can be played with. In the Egyptian tradition concerned with teachers, they say, in order to act wisely in different periods of transition, one has to know the rhythms and laws of the cycles of the universe. This forms part of the true temple. This is the basis on which these powers manifest. It's not like somebody sitting in there thinking, "I'll use this power and blow his mind." It is some being that is so much a statement of the laws of the universe that at the appropriate moment with a person, a certain flip of something happens which does the next thing. As Ramakrishna said, dislodging a green nut from a shell is almost impossible. But let it dry, and the slightest tap, the guru will do it. Okay? You get a nut just dried and just tap it, and the nut falls out of the shell. And you'll see, when you sit around one of these beings, hundreds of people will come to him, and each person they'll say, the people come up to Maharaj and they'll touch his feet and he'll say, he'll ignore, he'll just go on talking, you know. And they'll be given food and they'll leave the temple. And someone else will come, and that person by my standards would be somebody you should have just given food and water. I mean, it doesn't fill the bill at all, you know. It's not a drunken bhakta, you know. Maharaj will turn into a whole thing with the person. And I realize how unfathomable that law is from my rational mind as to what the guru's doing to who, why. This is an interesting insight into this whole power, use of powers. This is from Sai Baba of Shirdi. He was the one I told you once before about. He had these incredible powers. He used to go down to the stream and pull out his intestines and his stomach and wash them and hang them up over trees to dry. Remember that guy? Yeah. And when an old couple came to him and they cried because their money had been stolen and they couldn't get to see the Ganges River before they died, he said, "Don't worry about it." And the Ganges started to pour out of his toes. And he was known as having these incredible powers. I mean, he came to a little village at first and they all ignored him. They wouldn't have anything to do with him because he was kind of weird. And they wouldn't give him any oil for his lamp. So he went back, and they knew he didn't have any oil, and he just poured water into the lamp, and it burned. And that freaked them all, so they started to worship him. Okay. And it's the same thing of, I give them what they want, or I shake them up a bit, then they'll want what I give. It's like you get people shaken a bit, and then they're open to the possibility. And that's roughly the way powers are generally used. But here's Sai Baba, a quote. A woman's young son was bitten by a cobra, and she cried out and begged Sai Baba for sacred ash, but he did not give it, and the child died. H.S. Dixit, one of the oldest of the devotees, implored him, "Baba, her crying is heartrending. For my sake, revive her son." Sai Baba replied, "Do not get entangled in this. What has happened is for the best. He has already entered another body in which he can do specially good work, which he could not do in this one. If I draw him back into this body, then the new one he has entered will have to die for this to live. I might do it for your sake, but have you considered the consequences? Have you any idea of the responsibility, and are you prepared to assume it?" Okay. In America at the moment is Swami Muktananda from Ganesh Puri in India. And Swami Muktananda had a guru called Swami Nityananda. Swami Nityananda was quite a colorful fellow also, like Sai Baba. And Nityananda, thousands of people would come to see him every day, and he'd just sit there and he'd be going, and they got to interpret his movements, so they'd come and say, "Should I buy this stock, Babaji?" And they'd buy it and they'd make a killing, you know. And it was hard to know what he was doing, you know, but it was incredible, loving, very compassionate, being a very, very beautiful yogi. Very, very, he was an avadut siddha yoga, very without form, formless yoga. Brahman. And he used to put up money for the roads to be paved in the areas around. And he'd say to the workmen at the end of the day, go home and pick up any rock on your way home and your pay will be there. Right? And the 2 rupees. And so they go and they just pick up any rock along the way. Rupees. They wouldn't be under any other rock. Right? And the rupees were always new. And finally the police came to him. And they said, Babaji, we're a little concerned about where these rupees are coming from. And oh, he looked terribly concerned too. And he said, oh, I don't want you to be concerned. Come, I'll show you. And there was an inspector and his sergeant. And he took them off into the jungle, deeper and deeper into the jungle. And he finally came to a lake that was infested with crocodiles. And he went into the water. They were standing on the bank. Be careful, Guruji. Because it's delicate to come to a guru and ask him about where the money's coming from, you know, because he has a big following of thousands of people. And, oh, no, he wanted to show them. And he motioned, and a crocodile came over to him. And he opened the mouth of the crocodile, and he reached in, and he started to pull out new bills, you know, like, and the police went running out of the jungle. I mean, they had met their match. I'm sure many of you would like to have such powers, but it's... Muktananda used to, his method was the method of Guru Kripa, and he used to meditate on his guru. And in his autobiography, he would describe how he would do it. Meditating on a guru, installing him in all parts of your body. Sit down, feeling that the guru is confronting you. Kneel to him. Prostrate yourself to him. Address him. O Guru Dev, you comprise all. Bowing to him, inwardly meditate on the guru, realizing that the guru principle envelops you from each direction, above and below, front and behind. Afterwards, install him in your body. Remember that just as threads permeate cloth, and cloth is present in every thread, the guru is in you and you are in him. See the guru and yourself as one. As a pitcher is not different from clay, even so your guru is not different from you. With this knowledge, sit in a meditative posture. Touch your head with your hand and feel that it is the guru's head. Your forehead, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, throat, shoulders in turn, regarding them all as his features. Touching your chest, heart, abdomen, back, waist, thighs, knees, calves, and feet, feel they are all his and his alone. Touch your toes, considering them his. Along with this movement from head downwards, continue to chant Guru Om mentally. Full of the love of the guru, then start from the toes and in the same manner go up to the head. Thus installing the guru throughout the body, begin to meditate, feeling that you are yourself or the guru. You are the mantra, you are everything. The guru is in you, and you are in the guru. That's the hamsa soham. It's the merging with the guru. This is a method for merging. Meditate daily in this manner without the slightest doubt. And as he kept doing it, he got to the point where he started to fully identify. It's a way of just flipping your whole consciousness around. You've met a being that you can't find anywhere. It's formless. And you just start to incorporate it. Just as a child does, identifies with a parent. You just start to incorporate this whole other being. It's like when you contemplate on the words of Jesus or the words of Buddha. It's incorporating this stuff in. And Muktananda would get so flipped out that he wasn't sure most of the time who he was during this sadhana. The question is, what does one do in relation to a guru? What do you do in relation to the guru? I mean, this is what the guru does. The guru is just sitting around doing nothing, really, just manifesting itself. But what do you do? Ramana Maharshi says, the grace of the guru is like an ocean. If one comes with a cup, he'll only get a cupful. It's no use complaining about the niggardliness of the ocean. The bigger the vessel, the more you'll be able to carry. It's entirely up to you. And the strategy you take is, as St. John said, he that sent me is with me, he hath not left me alone, I do always the things that please him. For me, my process is merely hanging out with my guru. And I can't tell you how many times a day, not only on the dashboard of my car, next to my bed, in my puja room, in the kitchen by the refrigerator, are pictures of my guru, because I really dig hanging out with this being. But the mantra is taking me into him. The thoughts come up 1,000 times a day. When I'm sitting with an individual looking, it turns into my guru over and over again. It's merely just hanging out with this incredible being of consciousness, of love, of light, of presence. Just a way of hanging out. It's a way of opening oneself. And it's a process of surrendering. Maharaji said a lot of weird things. Maharaji said, Ram Dass, don't touch money. So I didn't touch money, which meant that I had a bagman, as I said to you, somebody who carried my money. Then I thought, that's phony. When I came back to America, I thought, I can't not touch money. It'll be such a heavy trip. So I'll touch money. Now, every time I touch money, I hear Maharaji saying, don't touch money. Right? And you can see the relationship. I'm not touching money, but I'm touching money, if you can hear that. In a way, I'm working with that relationship. And every time a quarter lands on my palm, there's Maharaji again, pointing at it, saying, don't touch money. Right? And I'm seeing the way my mind gets locked into the money. The quality of the guru is described in Walt Whitman in Leaves of Grass in this interesting inner guru way, the inner guru. It's what we call the witness. Now, a lot of people get freaked by the concept of the witness because they think it is merely another head trip. And in fact, at one level it is. But it is just as I say, there's my guru saying, don't touch money. There is the place in me saying, eating pizza, or whatever that place is. Just this quiet place. This conscious entity that is hanging around with me all the time, showing me, oh, you just got uptight. Not, you're bad to get uptight. It's not judgment. It's just, got uptight again, far out. How interesting. Whitman said, this is an interesting use of the word since it was written when Whitman wrote it. It starts out, trippers. Trippers and askers surround me. Trippers and askers, that's what we are at Naropa, with trippers and askers. Are you an asker or a tripper? I'd like to understand more about, oh, you're an asker. Hey, I had the most forward experience in my meditation. Ah, you're a tripper. Yeah, the world can be divided into trippers and askers. Trippers and askers surround me, asking about people I meet. The effect on me of my early life, or the ward and the city I live in, or the nation, the latest dates, discoveries, inventions, societies, authors, old and new, my dinner, dress, associates, looks, compliments, dues, the real and fancied indifference of some man or woman I love, the sickness of one of my folks or of myself, or ill-doing, or loss, or lack of money, or depressions, or exaltations, battles, the horror of fratricidal war, the fever of doubtful news, the fitful events. These come to me days and nights and go from me again. But they are not the me myself. Apart from the pulling and hauling, stands what I am, stands, and this is as close to I can describe Maharaji, stands amused, complacent, compassionate, idle, unitary, looks down, is erect, or bends an arm on an impalpable certain rest, looking with side-curved head, curious what will come next. Both in and out of the game, and watching and wondering at it. Backward I see in my own days where I sweated through fog with linguists and contenders. I have no mockings or arguments. I witness and wait. Guru, God, Self, One. Inner Guru. Walt Whitman's talking about. And what I've been saying to people when I've worked with them is that the minute you know that there is somebody that knows it all, you're free, because all your secrets become absurd, because somebody knows everything about you and they're saying, yeah, right, look at all that horrible stuff and here we are. Far out. Maharaji knows all my dirty laundry. I remember once I went into an ashram with a, it's a rent-a-cave. You rent it for 18 rupees a week. And they lock you and they pass food through a window. And it was very hot in there, so I was naked all the time. You know, usually you think of you're supposed to wear a loincloth or something. But I didn't care. I was all alone. I was locked in this place. So I was naked. He says, you know, it's good not to wear clothes. Really good not to wear clothes. Oh, yeah, Maharaji, thank you. I was in Bombay, and I started to drink scotch and sodas. I was with the president of an ashram, board of trustees. I was visiting his home, and I was a yogi, and he said, I'll tell you, the doctor said that for my heart I have to take a little scotch every night. And I said, oh, I understand. And he said, because it's not good to drink in India. Conscious beings don't drink, because it's not a very interesting drug, actually. So I went into his room expecting him to bring out a little medicine glass and pour it, but he brought out an ice bucket and two glasses. And I remember the days when I used to really love scotch and sodas. So he poured one and he said, would you like some soda water? I said, no, I'll join you. I figured tantra's for me, you know. So he poured a scotch soda and I got completely crocked. And we staggered through dinner. His wife was feeding us and I couldn't even find a table. And this was just in one drink. And the next evening we started a little earlier, you know, and it was one of these kind of things. And after about 3 days I went back north up to the mountains. To Vrindavan. And I got to Maharaji, and that evening he called me out to his table, and he started talking about this other yogi who was in America and who was being taken care of by these very devoted women. He says, he's with women. I said, yes, I know, Maharaji. He says, what does he call them? I said, he calls them his mothers. Oh, how old are they? I said, well, one's 20 years old. Oh, mothers. He was just taking me through this whole thing. He had been done it a dozen times before. He says, you know what his mothers give him? I said, no, what? He says, they give him milk. I said, that's wonderful, mothers, milk, that's just right on. He says, every night they give him milk. I said, oh, that's wonderful, Maharaji. Maharaji comes up really, really close and he says to me, you know what they put in the milk? I said, no, Maharaji, what do they put in the milk? He says, liquor. And I said, no. And he comes up to me and he says, yes. And he goes like that. So where am I going to hide? Where am I going to hide? You think because he's not in a body it makes any difference? There's that constant feeling. If you can't hide, it's all out in the open. And if it's all out in the open, well, here we are. You got to take it the way. You got to be what you are because you can't make believe you're something else because who are you going to fool? It's far out. There's just nowhere to lock the door. And that's quite freeing, it turns out, when people realize that. So this relation of the witness is the observer and the observed, and ultimately these two will come together, but they must come together when they do come together. And the levels of the witness start from the lower level, which is the witness in the lower mind, which is a part of the ego observing the other ego. And then slowly, slowly, that you become more that witness and less what's witnessed. And then pretty soon you start to connect with the deeper places in yourself, the ultimate one of which is this big W witness, which just sees everything but is not attached to looking. There's no ego tripping about it. It's just seeing it all. At this point, here's what is about to happen now. We will do arti, which I'm going to just tell you about for a moment. And when we do this arti, I'd like you to understand what the words mean when you're hearing it. Om Jaya Jagadish Hari. Hail to the Lord of the Universe. Hail, Master Lord of the Universe, who removes in a moment the trouble of devotees and the trouble of the humbled. Jodhyawe Palapawe. He who approaches you gets the fruit. The sorrows of the heart are destroyed. Happiness, wealth come to the home. Physical suffering of the body is removed. You are my mother and my father, from whom I seek refuge. Without you there is no other. In whom else can I hope? You are the complete Paramatma, that which is beyond the Atma, the Brahman. You are omniscient.
You are beyond Brahma. You are the master of all. You are an ocean of compassion. Tum Karuna Kesagira. I am the servant, you are the master. Preserver, bestow your grace. You are the invisible one, protector of all life force. You who are full of compassion, by what method could I, in my ignorance, hope to meet you? Brother of the meek and reliever of sorrow, you are my savior or protector. Raise your hand, I am lying at your door. Remove my indulgence in worldly objects. O God, remove sin. Increase my reverence and devotion so that I may serve the saints. There will be, arti means light, the offering of light, and up here the light will be offered to Maharaji as well as the food be consecrated. We're just trying to show you what part of this process of devotional yoga is about.